We've been so fortunate every day during the COVID-19 pandemic spread to be able to have a medical professional with us, an infectious disease specialist or epidemiologist or public health authority to walk us through what we're learning about COVID-19 and to also elaborate on the protective measures that public health officials have implemented to try and slow the spread of COVID-19. We're very pleased to have back with us today from Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, infectious disease specialist, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Dr. Schreiner, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. Nice to be here.
So we want to invite listeners to give us a call. Our phone lines are open for you at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. You can also tweet at AirTalk or ask a question via Facebook and our AirTalk Facebook page. Dr. Schreiner, let's talk about the expansion of testing sites in Southern California, and people having the ability now to apply who have symptoms that they believe could indicate COVID-19. They don't have to necessarily be high risk or older. How is this going to affect, do you think, the tabulation of cases?
Well, I'm hoping that it will actually give us a much better handle on exactly how much virus we have in the community and perhaps help allay some anxieties about where this is all going. I think this will give us much more information in terms of those that might be asymptomatic or those that are symptomatic. And although it's really sort of just in its infancy right now, I think that it will be very helpful. And it just sort of illustrates how fast we're moving along. 2 weeks ago, we were just begging for testing sites, and it was very, very difficult to get testing. And now we're having many more platforms, both in the hospital and available to the public. So I think it will be of great help. There are some issues in terms of following up on the test results and gathering the epidemiologic information, but I think overall it's a very, very positive move.
Has the delay in getting results, has that largely gone away, or are there still some of the test sites that are taking a while?
Well, there's still some that take a while, and I think each time you make a change in how you do testing and the availability of testing and certainly the volume of testing, that may impact a little bit of the delay time between testing and results. But for the most part, most of the outside laboratories that are doing it, and we also now are doing it in-house at Huntington Hospital, as are many hospitals, that time has really diminished. So we can get results back in as little as 2 or 3 hours if we need to. Those tests are a little bit more in short supply, but the general public, even, it's usually between 12 and 24 hours before results.
And protective gear for your hospital employees there, face masks, surgical masks, does pretty much everybody have one now?
Well, yes. I mean, that's always an ongoing concern because we haven't really gotten to the point where we're going to, you know, really have to ramp up the amount of patients that we're going to be seeing. I think it's been a sort of a slow, steady increase. But I think that right now we've mandated that everyone wear a mask in the hospital now. Not so much, it's really in response to the fact that we know the virus is circulating in the community. So there's a certain point where you do different stages. At first, you may not need to use a mask. And then as the virus becomes much more common and the likelihood you're going to encounter somebody with the virus increases, then we finally got to the stage that everybody who's at the hospital must wear a mask. And then, of course, we have higher levels of protective gear for dealing with patients that have actual disease.
N95 masks and full body covering, that sort of thing?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Those are still a very precious commodity, but we have enough right now to handle what we're doing, and those are for the healthcare workers that are actually dealing with these patients.
We're talking with Huntington Hospital infectious disease specialist Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Do you have a sense of what your ICU census is looking like?
It's pretty full. We still have some patients that don't have a coronavirus. You know, we still are a functioning hospital, and so we're taking care of trauma patients and patients that are critically ill, who thankfully have not become infected with the virus. We have those patients separated from the coronavirus patients. But we have contingency plans for expanding our ICU within the facility itself, and hopefully we won't have to go beyond that, but we also have plans for that as well if we need to. I think the big rate-limiting factor for all intensive care units throughout the world, frankly, are ventilators. And right now we certainly have enough to cover things if it increases substantially. But if we get overwhelmed, then that could be a whole different story.
When you look at the figures in Los Angeles County, you look at what's happening in New York City, are you taking any solace in what appears to be the slowing of the rate of increase?
I would very much like to, and I'm cautiously, very cautiously optimistic, but we don't want to be too cavalier about this because there's several factors here. I mean, certainly Los Angeles doesn't have the intense density of population that a city like New York has, and that may have helped us even before we instituted social distancing. But I applaud Governor Newsom and Mayor Garcetti for doing that very early. I think that is really showing the benefits of that right now. And it's a very simple, very old-fashioned epidemiologic tool, but it works. And so I certainly would agree with them that we need to continue to emphasize these are the critical 2 or 3 weeks that we're now entering, and it is absolutely imperative that people not make any trips outside their home if they don't have to, and just to stay put until we kind of ride over the wave here.
So you agree with Dr. Barbara Frere, Director of Public Health for L.A. County, that best for people to even avoid grocery shopping this week because this week is so critical?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Dr. Frere, I really applaud her. I've heard her on your show, and she's just been fantastic and very sensible and easy to understand. And I think she's giving exactly the right direction. This is kind of the next 2 weeks, 10 days to 2 weeks are really the critical period. And it's just so very important that people not go out and infect other people.
We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital, Pasadena infectious disease specialist. She's our expert today, taking your calls at 866-893-KPCC. Already have a number of listener questions, which I'll share with her when we come back. I just want to take a moment, though, to thank you for the tremendous outpouring of support that we've been receiving from listeners like you as we're working under a very different circumstance than the past, with much of our team working from home and all of us trying to pull together to put on the most useful program we can every day. We just thank you for your support. It means a great deal. We'll continue with more conversation in 90 seconds on Air Talk. Coming up next hour on Air Talk, Los Angeles County Sheriff Alex Villanueva is with me. We're going to talk about a number of important issues. We've talked a lot about homeless Angelenos, their vulnerability to COVID-19. There's another highly vulnerable population, and that's those that are in jail in Los Angeles County facilities. We'll talk with the sheriff about what measures are being taken to try and protect inmates, as well as deputies who are working in those facilities, other staff members, healthcare providers in the jails. It's a huge operation, thousands of inmates in the county, and obviously the potential for the pandemic to have a huge effect in those kinds of institutional settings. So just one of the topics we'll take up with the sheriff next hour on Air Talk. Right now, we're talking with Huntington Hospital infectious disease specialist, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Let's talk with Sarah in Santa Monica. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Sustaining member here.
Appreciate it.
I wanted to know, I live alone. I'm over 65. I live in a building that has 10 units. Basically, we've got maybe 14, 15 people all told living here. We've got a laundry room. We've got a trash area out back. We each have front and back door entrances. Every time I go out to drop off the trash, to go into the laundry room, just to open my front door, step out onto the stoop, do I have to come back in and wash my hands and wipe down the bottoms of my shoes? Is that necessary?
Sarah, you sound so youthful for someone over 65. Our producer Fiona knows that. I did too. I appreciate the call. So does she have to go to those lengths every time she steps outside, Dr. Schreiner?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that it is prudent during these times to be extra cautious. And just even thinking, if you think I should wash my hands, go wash your hands. I think it is helpful because that is a very well-recognized modality of transmission if you happen to touch something that may have some active virus on it. You know, the truth is that most of the time this virus is spread through respiratory droplets from one person to another, but there are contact transmissions that can occur. you know, washing your shoes off, what might be reasonable is just keep a pair of shoes just outside your door if you can, and that's the pair that you wear around outside, and then once in a while just wash them down if you can. That's certainly what I do when I come home from the hospital, is I take my shoes off before I enter the house, and then I clean them later. So I think that it's prudent. It's probably extra precaution, but, you know, these are desperate times, and so we have to do desperate things, and I think you're right on target by doing those things.
All right, Sarah, thanks so much. Anna Lee in South Pasadena, I understand your father is in an ICU unit with coronavirus?
Yeah, that's correct. My 80-year-old father has been hospitalized for the last 11 days. And thank goodness he is improving and is taking less oxygen. And my question for Dr. Schreiner is about post-acute care for these patients. He might likely be released on oxygen, and, you know, our family is preparing for this. He lives with my 79-year-old mother, and I'm just wondering what suggestions you have. I've been told that he will still be COVID-19 positive when he's released, and what can our family do to protect my mother and to keep his home safe?
Great. Great question, Dr. Schreiner.
Those are very good questions, Anna, and I think that, you know, this is the situation, is that we do have to discharge patients even though they're probably still positive. We don't wait for a negative test, because, of course, we need those beds, and that's such a critical factor in keeping the healthcare systems functional. But it is an anxiety for families when they take family members home. So what we recommend is they continue to self-isolate as best you can. You know, if he has a place where he can be and be separated from the rest of your family, especially from his wife, although that seems a rather sad thing to do right now, but certainly important, at least for the next 10 to 14 days after he comes home. When people are tending to him, you need to bring things to him or take care of him. It's probably prudent to, if you can, wear a mask and gloves, if you can. Or if you can't wear gloves, then certainly wash your hands very well and try to keep everything as clean as possible and his contact with the rest of the family to a minimum, at least for the next 10 to 14 days. After that, as he continues to improve, we feel that probably the infectious risk of people is less. We're not really entirely certain what that period of time is. We think it's mostly around 14 days, but there have been some studies that have looked at the persistent virus counts in people as long as 21 days after the symptoms resolve. Whether they're still infectious or not is a different question, because we don't know if you have low levels of virus if you're still an infectious person. But I think it is very difficult for families that maybe have minimal amounts of space in their house. But the best you could do to keep him isolated from the rest of the family for the next 10 to 14 days is really critical.
This is not an option, obviously, for many families and undoubtedly the majority of people. But if Annalise's family had the financial means that they could have someone come in during the day for the next several days to be the interface with Annalise's father, to keep Annalise's mother more protected, would that be worthwhile? Or does that, in bringing an outside person into the home, create more risk?
It could do either. I mean, it's certainly always helpful to have, you know, home health. We do that in normal circumstances when we have elderly parents or people that have, you know, high acuity problems. And it's the home health services we have available to us are just terrific, and they often have just fantastic nurses and social workers to help with those sort of situations. But it does introduce another person, and so there is that factor. Now, most of those agencies are very meticulous, and they're very much aware of what's going on right now. So if it was a need that was really required to maintain his health and keep him out of the hospital for a second time, then I would say it might be worth it. But you really have to weigh the pros and cons of bringing another person in.
I guess I'm trying to think of keeping her mother safe, who's 79, as sort of...
Yeah, the main thing is just to really keep them away from each other for the time being. I know that sounds terrible, but they can Facebook or FaceTime or talk through the door or whatever. But I think it's just important that they not, while he's potentially still infectious, really stay away from.
We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Lynn in Los Alamitos has a good question. Her mother lives in a large assisted living facility near where she lives in Stanton. And at the facility, they're doing temperature taking each day for every one of the residents. And Lynn wonders, Does that introduce additional risk of her mother being exposed to COVID-19 in that different people are coming in to her? It sounds like she's living independently, so different people coming into her unit and taking her temperature every day.
Well, it's sort of the same situation, is that anytime you introduce another person, especially if it's not the same person, each person that comes in, you don't know who their contacts have been. And because we do know this virus can be harbored in people that aren't symptomatic, we really don't know. Now, I'm hoping that that person who's coming in is wearing a mask and keeping as much distance from these people as possible. You can take a temperature now without touching people. And so that would diminish the risk quite a bit. The value of temperature taking is always a little bit unclear because, of course, people's fevers go up and down, and sometimes they take Tylenol, and we also know that people don't always have a fever with this disease, so it isn't an absolute. But again, the more people you introduce into facilities that have high-risk individuals, the more chance there is that they're going to finally encounter somebody who actually is infected.
Denise, in Crenshaw Manor, Southwest Los Angeles, ask, why is this week and next week so critical, given that we've been sheltering in place for a few weeks now?
Because if you look at the statistics, they are increasing in Los Angeles, and they thankfully are not doing the same rate of increase that in highly dense areas like New York City. But it is definitely increasing, and the more you have, more virus you actually have circulating in the population, the more likely it is that transmission is going to occur. And again, it's sort of an analogy that I used a few days ago, is it's sort of like fleas on a dog. If the dogs are far enough apart, the fleas can't jump from one dog to the next. And when you have a high amount of people that might be infected because the virus has had a chance to circulate in that population, which it's been doing probably for the last month or so, then the risk of infecting other people is so much higher. So as we approach this surge, you see this pattern over and over again. We saw it in China. We've certainly seen it in Italy in a very dramatic way. And we're actually seeing it in New York, where you start beginning to see the number of deaths go down and then eventually beginning to see the number of infections go down. That's classic for these kind of pandemics. So we are kind of on the upswing of the surge right now. And it usually lasts anywhere from, you know, the actual surge anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks. Because we have a slower uptick and we've been doing social distancing, that might be a longer period of time. But it's just so very critical that right now, when there's quite a bit of virus circulating, that we stop it by social distancing.
We'll continue our conversation with Huntington Hospital infectious disease specialist Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, joining us from just around the corner from our Pasadena studios. So glad to have her expertise with us. We have many more calls coming up, including one from Deborah listening up in Monterey. She's going to ask about masks. We'll get some more details on that. We have other excellent questions to ask Dr. Schreiner. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Back in 1 minute. I can't tell you how otherworldly it is to look across the glass in the opposite connected side of our studio and to be looking at Parker McDaniel, our engineer, with his surgical mask on, Fiona Ng, who's line producing, her surgical mask on. To her left, they're screening phone calls, doing social media, our news apprentices, Sabrina Fang, Julia Murray, also masked up. It's odd. Obviously, I can't be. Plus, I'm sitting by myself. No one comes into this studio where I'm at each day. Studio A is just totally set up for one person. And when I step out, I have my mask off, whether I'm going to the restroom or going to my car to and from. It's just otherworldly. And if you're someone who is providing what's determined to be an essential service, I'm sure you're seeing that too. Hospitals, less odd to see that, but in a typical workplace, definitely a different feel to it. We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital, Pasadena, infectious disease specialist. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Deborah joins us from beautiful Monterey. Deborah, thank you. Go right ahead with your question.
Hi. I'm a little confused as to the protection that's afforded by an ordinary mask. It seems like we're now hearing that the mask prevents the wearer from becoming infected. And my understanding has been that actually it doesn't do that, but it protects other people from the wearer if the wearer happens to be infected. So I think that needs clarification.
All right.
Me if I go out, or does it only protect whoever I encounter from me?
Very good. Deborah, thank you so much. Dr. Schreiner?
Well, Deborah, you're absolutely right. Really, the main function of the masks is to protect you or protect other people from you. Most of the masks that people use out in the non-hospital setting are surgical masks or the cloth masks that many people are using now. And basically what those do is serve as a barrier from mucus that you might have in you when you're talking or coughing or sneezing around other people. And we, of course, want everybody to try not to cough and sneeze around other people if possible. But we know that mucus comes out even when you speak and when you sing and when you exhale. So that really is that you're absolutely right. The barrier is more to protect other people from your mucus. It does serve a little bit of a barrier from for other people. I mean, it is, you know, it certainly diminishes the amount of actual droplets that might get into your own mucous membranes. But those type of masks tend not to be as effective as, for example, an N95 mask in providing that kind of protection.
Let's see. We have Glenn asks on the page, what are the odds that life might return largely to normal by fall, including schools being able to open for normal sessions? Or is it more likely that social separation may have to go on for a year or so, or perhaps come and go in periodic waves?
That's the million-dollar question, is when does life go back to normal? I think we're going to have a new normal. I think that this pandemic, the good things that will come out of it are that we learn how important it is to prepare for an event like this. This will not be the last pandemic. These are going to become much more common, I think, as, again, we have more encounters with viruses that our species has never seen before. I think that we will be able to learn how to understand what kind of measures are effective. We certainly know that social distancing is effective. We may have, by the fall, hopefully we might have a good grasp on some therapeutic interventions, whether it's neutralizing antibodies or some of the medications that are being looked at, antivirals that are being evaluated. And we might even have the beginnings of some vaccine trials at that point to sort of help us ease some of the burden of the disease in the populations. But I think that it is important to be very cautious. These type of viruses, coronaviruses, tend to be cyclical. This happened with the first SARS outbreak. It was not nearly as spread out through the globe as this one, but it did recur a little bit in late August and September and then finally disappeared. So I think there's lots of things that can happen also by the fall, is that the herd, you know, we are the herd, will become much more immune. And so, again, there won't be many sort of non-immune hosts for the virus to interact with. But I think we need to pay attention to what this is doing to our life and our economy and our society and our planet, and hopefully learn from that, and that will help us deal with the next pandemic that will come along.
Melissa in Adelanto in the high desert says her husband has a colonoscopy scheduled next week. Should we reschedule? I'm assuming that's a routine colonoscopy, but it might be different advice if he'd had an occult blood test that was positive. What do you think, doctor?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Larry. I think we want people, anything that's entirely elective that really isn't going to be a life-saving intervention or of great critical diagnostic importance, those should be postponed for as long as possible. You know, but sometimes somebody has, as you mentioned, they have a reason that they need to have the colonoscopy done. There's a concern for cancer. Those are not things that we want to postpone, and I would think that their gastroenterologist would be prepared to deal with a patient that, you know, may or may not be exposed to coronavirus. We certainly are doing that with most of our surgeries. The truly elective surgeries have been postponed at Huntington, but we still continue to do many surgeries for patients that just really can't wait.
Deanna in El Sereno says, I have the symptoms. I talked with my doctor who put me on 14-day quarantine. I was tested. Results came negative, but I'm still sick. My daughter is starting to show the symptoms too. Are false negatives possible?
You know, this is a concern that we've had. I just was talking to some physicians about this earlier this morning, is that these tests are quite good, the nasopharyngeal swab. if they're done properly and the material is collected properly, they're about 98% accurate. There are problems sometimes with collection, and sometimes the specimen can be mishandled so that the test may be falsely negative. But chances are that the caller probably has another virus. This, of course, we're still in the middle of the sort of the end, tail end of the flu season, and some of the other viruses like human metapneumovirus or rhinovirus, and those are still circulating. I hope that those actually will begin to fade a little faster, too, because of social distancing. But if the test is negative, it probably means you're not infected with coronavirus. There really, it isn't that common. Very high suspicion cases we will retest. And sometimes, as I said, if the sample's not collected properly, it may be falsely negative. But to continue to get retesting is problematic because the tests are a pretty precious resource.
Thank you so much, Dr. Schreiner. Wonderful to have you with us again today on Air Talk.
Pleasure, Larry.
Thank you. Infectious disease specialist at Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner with us. We have much more to come in the second hour of Air Talk. I'll tell you about it in about a minute.